Good evening and welcome to Coast AM. I'm Dave Schrader, your host for this evening. Faring decent this week in Minnesota as we're facing the polar vortex, seems to be shifting and going away from us. The misery index, which I never even knew we kept here in Minnesota, unbelievably alarming rates. This is the worst, coldest, and most miserable winter in over 30 years. I don't even think they needed to report that, as obviously everybody living in Minnesota knew that already. I saw something tonight that was absolutely astounding. I want to make a mention of this. Intrigue Theater is visiting here in Minnesota, and they know they're doing a tour. They're going to be popping up in different parts of the United States. If you're a fan of the paranormal or of the supernatural, I can't recommend the show any higher rating ever. This has got to be one of the coolest shows I've ever seen. They have this illusion and mediumship show. They actually do a throwback to the turn of the century from the 19th to 20th century spiritualism, those old parlor meetings where they would have entertainers come in and mediums, and they actually tackle all of these different topics, and they do mediumship, they do ghosts, seances, voodoo, witchcraft, time travel, which really astounded me. This really cool hypnotherapy, time travel, wibbly wobbly deal that went on, and it just absolutely, I'm blown away. And after 9 years of doing radio and traveling around the world to see amazing things, this has got to be one of the best live shows I've ever seen. So check out IntrigueTheater.com. If you guys are out there around the United States looking for an entertainment bang for your buck, I don't think you'll find anything better. This totally knocked me out tonight. Great show. I can't wait. I look forward to going back to it again. I wanted to mention that because, again, that's fun. That's entertainment. That's bringing the illusion of the paranormal back into the now. And it shows you how easily the mind can be manipulated and made to believe that things are real. Well, what happens when it's not entertainment? It's not just a movie about a possessed house in Amityville, New York, or a young girl possessed by demons. What if it's a reality? What if something actually happens out there that brings darkness to somebody's life? Well, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. The Demon of Brownsville Road, a Pittsburgh family's battle with evil in their home. Bob Cranmer, our guest, will be joining us. Back in October of 1988, Bob Cranmer buys a house in Pittsburgh in a suburb he grew up in, but had no idea that his dream home was about to become his worst nightmare. And it seems the Cranmers were fated to own this house at 3406 Brownsville Road because as a young boy, Bob had been drawn to the property. And just when the family decided to move back to Brentwood, the house went up for sale. Without a second thought, they purchased that house that Bob had always been dreaming of owning. When we come back, we'll find out about this dream house that quickly slipped into nightmare status. That's what we've got coming up for you for the next 2 hours here on Coast to Coast AM. In October of 1988, our guest Bob Cranmer bought a house in the Pittsburgh suburb he grew up in. He had no idea that his dream home was about to become his worst nightmare. Bob Cranmer faced an evil presence that tormented his family, and he involved himself in an epic spiritual war he fought to save everything he held dear. Bob Cranmer joins us now on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, thank you for staying up late with us this evening.
Hey, Dave, thank you. It's an honor and a privilege, really, to be on your show. And it's really mind-blowing that, I've come to this point after working on this book for so long and trying to get it published and finally succeeding. And now before it's even been printed, the amount of attention that it's getting is really phenomenal.
Well, the story has been breaking for weeks over the news. And I think it's because it's not just some family seeking fortune and riches. I think it's because of who you are, Bob, and your background. So why don't we start for our audience there so they can get a better understanding of who we're speaking with. And tell us a little bit about you and your life up to the point when you bought this house.
Well, up until the point I bought the house, as you had previously stated, I grew up in the little suburb of Brentwood, which is right on the border of the city of Pittsburgh within Allegheny County. Typical 1950, 1960 upbringing. Graduated from Duquesne University here in Pittsburgh. Went on to a what I thought was a career in the military. Followed my father. After 9 years, my wife and I decided that that's not exactly the life that we wanted for our children. Left the military by way of a short time in New Jersey. Was fortunate to get a transfer with my company back to Pittsburgh. And as you also stated, this house that had always intrigued me since the time I was a small child, all of a sudden came up for sale. I mean, miraculously. And we ended up buying it. And thus the story began.
Now, what's also intriguing to me is, I mean, kind of skirted over your career in the military, but I mean, you've come from a high place. This isn't a man that doesn't have a learned background or maybe easily fooled or influenced. You were commissioned as a second lieutenant of military intelligence in the regular army. You also served various assignments with the 101st Airborne Division and in Washington, D.C. You did that, and then leaving the Army in 1986, you started entering into politics. So you've been involved in politics in the Pittsburgh and surrounding area for a number of years as well.
Sure, I can review that as well. After we came back, I settled in my little town. Typical, want to get involved in the community and so on. Young family, noticed in my absence the community had changed somewhat, gone downhill, got involved in local politics, had a significant impact on the city council. And then moved up to the position of Allegheny County Commissioner, which is a pretty significant position, not only in western Pennsylvania, but in the state of Pennsylvania. Allegheny County is the second largest, most populous county in the state. At the time, three-quarter of a billion-dollar budget, 7,700 employees, a big... big operation. Went on to be what I felt successful. We built a couple of sports stadiums, one for the Pittsburgh Pirates, one for the Pittsburgh Steelers, new convention center, basically revamped the city along with the then mayor of Pittsburgh, Tom Murphy, and accomplished some pretty significant things. So, yes, when this story broke locally several weeks ago, it really had an impact because so many of the people here, million plus people know who I am and know my credibility as an elected official and a reputable individual.
Right, and I think that's what's an important part of the story and why it's garnering such worldwide attention right now, months before your book is due out, I believe, in August of this year. But it's already exploding in news and stories across tabloids and everything across the United States and around the world. As somebody who has a political background and is well-known and a face of the community, was it hard for you to come forward with the story you're about to share?
Well, it has surprised me. As I said, publishing a book is not easy, certainly when you're not a professional writer or have had anything to do with the publishing business. So it was a real long process of writing the book initially and then trying to figure out, how you approach a publisher and getting it published. So it's been a number of years. I wrote the book in 2007 and then went on and look for a publisher, and the Discovery Channel ended up picking up the story and doing a half-hour documentary on it, and that's kind of was over the hump. I was able to get some attention based upon that, and I've just been very surprised when the publisher put it up for sale several weeks ago how it took off, and put it on Amazon, and I've been taking interview requests since, so pretty amazing.
I think, it's because it's such an intriguing story, and it's not coming from, and I'm certainly understand, Bob, this is no disrespect, but, you know, a lot of politicians cannot always necessarily be trusted. But when it comes to a story like this, and you're putting your reputation and your good name on the line by sharing this, that, I think, is what intrigues me so much about the story. When I began my journey with my radio show 9 years ago, one of the first things I had attended was a big paranormal conference at Penn State College with the paranormal group that ran there and their advisor, Adam Bly, who George had on the show earlier this week. And I remember them telling me about this unbelievable case that they couldn't release any information about because the person was a pretty big name in politics there and showed me photographs that were disturbing. Black masses, things moving from mirror to mirror and crossing the room, blocking out light, just strange occurrences over and over. And then here, this nine years later, you come out and you develop and open up about this story. And I believe Ryan Buell has actually gone on record as saying he would say this is one of the scariest places on earth. And Ryan Buell, the lead investigator from the TV series Paranormal State. So let's start with your story. 1988, you go back to your town, you're able to purchase this house that you've wanted since you were a child, a piece of property that fascinated you. How soon after moving into that house, Bob, did activity occur that made you realize that maybe you weren't alone in this house?
Within I would say 2 to 3 weeks, as I can recall, my wife and I started to notice activity that was we couldn't explain. And again, we had never experienced anything paranormal or had any interest in it. We bought this big old cavernous house with 3 floors, and we were only able to, at the time, furnish half of it. Still a lot of empty rooms. We had 4 children, 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a newborn. And we were just looking to settle in, and things started to happen that didn't make sense. And the one that comes to mind initially is there's a walk-in closet underneath the large wooden staircase that goes up to the second floor, and it's a closet where I kept my overcoat when I'd go to work in the morning. I would take my coat, put it on, go to work, come home at night, and open the closet door. And inside the door is a light that looks like at one time it might have been a gas light. At least it's designed to look like one, with a pull chain on it. So I would reach into the closet to turn on the light, pull the chain, and when I pull on the chain, it would either be wrapped around one of the little screws that hold the globe on so it wouldn't pull, or the chain would be wrapped around the top of the light. So I was always fumbling in the dark to grab that chain. And after that happened a few times, I told my wife, who I suspected was just going in the closet and letting the chain fly, and it was wrapping itself around the light. And I said, please, when you go in there, don't let it fly, because I can't find it. And the one particular day I said that, she said, I haven't even been in that closet for several days, which, I struck us both as odd. And I said, okay. The next day, took the light. I said, okay, I'm closing this door. I don't want you to open again all day until I get home. Came home, opened it up. The chain was wrapped around the light. So at that point in time, both of us knew something was going on. The children were small. The light was, a good 5 feet off the floor. So none of them, if they wanted to or even thought of it, they were young babies, would have been able to do it. So we knew at that point in time there was some activity going on that we couldn't explain. And it wasn't too much long after that we realized we lived in a haunted house, but at the time it didn't seem to be threatening.
Well, how do you go from, understandably, that's weird phenomena, but to go from, the light chain keeps wrapping itself around this, to, well, this must be a haunted house. How did you make that logical leap?
Well, along with that, in the coming weeks, other things, again, that seemed innocent enough would happen. We would come down in the morning and all the lights would be turned on, especially in the basement. Sometimes I'd go down, all the lights would be on, and the radio would be playing. So we knew that there was something strange going on, but again, it was benevolent. It just didn't seem to be any threat, and we thought, okay, well, we'll just live with this and see where it goes. It was an interesting curiosity.
All right, so you start off with these little things amping up, and having this kind of gotten out, according to the press release, says that you started having lights flickering, you started having footsteps and things moving about in the house, and items would move about that weren't being touched. How soon did it start picking up and escalating like that?
Well, that went on for, you know, we moved in the house, in, as you had said, at the end of 1988. For a number of years into the 1990s, as the kids grew older, and they grew old enough to experience some of these things themselves and would tell us they, you know, heard footsteps at night or heard knocking on the doors or on the walls. And I generally would just discount it and say, you were dreaming. That went on into the 1990s. And then some other things started to happen that at the time I didn't realize was related to this entity, as we came to call it, that lived in the house. And later on, after things really developed, I realized that this thing was beginning to work on us early on, that it was working on our personalities, it was working on the children. In 1996, my wife, who was in her mid-30s at the time, had what amounted to be a nervous breakdown. And prior to that, she was just a normal, young, effervescent personality. And this came out of nowhere. Spent several weeks in the psychiatric ward and took some time to recover from it. And again, at the time, I didn't realize what this thing was doing, but it was slowly starting to work on the children. They were continuously fighting with each other. It was turning into a very disruptive situation that defied logic at the time. There was no reason for this activity to escalate the way it did. But
how old were the children when you first moved into the house?
Well, our oldest was 4 years old. My oldest son was 3 years old. The next son was 2 years old. And my youngest son, who's 25 now, was a newborn.
All right.
So it was pretty innocent.
Okay. And when it started to really amp up, when it really started to get bad and things put your wife into a state of mental duress, how old were the children at that point?
Well, by that time, Jessica, our oldest, was probably 11 or 12 years old. So they were, you know, they were 10, 9, 8, or 10, 9. Youngest would have been 7 by then.
Were you noticing that any of the activity was centering around any one of the children more than the others?
Well, yes. I'm glad you asked, because I was trying to think how I would work this into the conversation. But my oldest son, who ended up being most affected throughout this this whole traumatic experience, I feel was targeted as a three-year-old when we moved in. In fact, there's a picture of him on the cover of the book, standing in front of the house as a tiny little guy in front of this big cap, this giant house. It looks like it's ready to swallow him up, and in a way, the house was. His personality, which had been a, young, chipper little boy who liked to do somersaults and, you know, climb trees and so on, became very introverted. We moved him in to one.
Well, we have to take a quick break, Bob. When we come back, we'll find out about the change in your young son and how that began to amp up the haunting that our guest had to deal with. We're here for the evening. Bob Cranmer, our guest, as we continue talking about his story, The Demon of Brownsville Road, here on Coast to Coast AM. We are speaking this evening with our guest, Bob Cranmer, and the name of his book, The Demon of Brownsville Road, will be out a little bit later this year, finding out about his very strange experiences with a home that he purchased in 1988. And prior to the break, he was talking to us about the fact that the hauntings were actually centered around or seemed to be focused mainly on his young son. And it was within a short amount of time of moving into this house that activity began. Your son was about 4 or 5, you said, when you moved into the house, Bob. Is that right?
This particular son was 3.
Three.
My son, Bob Jr., who just, by the way, sent me a text message and said, wake up. So he's listening at home.
So he was about 3 years old. And did the activity center around him right from the get-go?
It did. We moved him into, this is a large house on the second floor alone, has 5 bedrooms, and we moved him into one of the large bedrooms in the front, which subsequently, years later, as I researched this house and talked to previous owners and so on, found out that this bedroom was not used as a bedroom by previous owners. They didn't tell me why. I'd later find out why. But we moved Bobby into this bedroom, and he wouldn't sleep in his bed. There was a walk-in closet. Every morning we'd find him with the light on in the closet, sleeping on the floor. Or at night we'd find him. I'd put him back in his bed. He'd get back in the closet. So finally my wife just put a small crib mattress in the floor, and he slept in the closet for about a year. His personality began to change a month or so after we had moved in, or maybe 2 months after.
Now, was he explaining to you why he wanted to sleep in the closet, or?
No, he didn't. He just said, I don't like my bed. I don't like the bed. I like the closet. So he just had this personality. You didn't argue with him. That's where he wants to be. That's where he would be. So it was probably that we moved in. We actually moved in December. Later, probably in March, as it was beginning to, spring was approaching, as I can recall. My mother, who was Roman Catholic, we were Protestant, suggested that one of the local Catholic priests come to the house and perform a ritual blessing of a house, which is not uncommon. And she said she would arrange it, and I thought, well, you know, that's great. I wasn't a Catholic. I really didn't buy into all the ritual and so on, but to make my mother happy. And also just to kind of allay some creepy feelings I had about the house that were, you know, in the back of my mind, again, with this activity going on in the house, I said, yeah, okay, let's do it.
Maybe right, err on the side of safety, sure.
So we're going through the second floor, blessing the bedrooms as a family. And the priest is in his priestly garb, and he has holy water. And as we approach Bobby's room, there's this little guy, 3 years old, stands in the doorway to his room in the form of an X, with his arms and his feet wedged against the door frame. And he looks the priest dead in the eye, and he said, "You're not coming in this room." And I obviously said, "Hey, Bobby, get out of the way." And he said, "He's not coming in this room. Get away from this room." So the priest, all of a sudden, you know, sensing there was going to be some kind of a little confrontation that he didn't want to cause, just said, "Oh, that's all right." You know, and he just walked by to the next bedroom. That's something else I logged in my memory at the time that was just strange and out of character. But again, years later, I would come to fully understand the significance of that bedroom, some bad things that went on in that bedroom, and also why previous owners did not use it as a bedroom.
We have to go to another break, Bob. But let me ask a quick question for you, just to get an understanding. Your son, Bobby Jr., this is the young boy who refused to let the priest into his room and was very stoic and standing and steadfast and not allowing this to happen. Are there any medical conditions that he suffers that you either knew about at that time or found out afterwards?
Years later, as this thing began to manifest itself, first keying in on my wife, and I must also just give a quick caveat that my wife and I moved into that bedroom in 1995, months before she had what amounted to her nervous breakdown. So she and two other of my sons eventually would end up in psychiatric hospitals.
Were any of them ever diagnosed with a form of epilepsy at all?
No, they were completely healthy, as they are completely normal today.
The reason I ask is we find in a lot of hauntings, there's usually something called a poltergeist agent, usually one person that it focuses around. And in a lot of studies and work done by a noted parapsychologist like Dr. Barry Taff in his book, Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, he talks about a majority of these cases. Usually the people involved deal with some form of epilepsy. And I was just curious if there was any kind of medical trait that may be tied to why they were so affected as opposed to other people in your family. We need to take another break. We'll come back and continue our journey as we learn more about the demon of Brownsville Road on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader, our guest for this evening, Bob Kramer. And we're talking about his book, The Demon of Brownsville Road, A Pittsburgh Family's Battle with Evil in Their Home. And we're talking about all the activity that's taken place there and the fact that this one room seems to be almost the focal point of the house. Your son, from the age of three, refuses to sleep in his bed. He'd rather sleep in a closet and avoid the room. He doesn't want the priest to come in and bless the room. You and your wife took it over at one point, which led to a mental breakdown for her. Both of your sons who'd spent time in there ended up having issues. At any point, did you think it's time to pick my family up and get the hell out of this house?
Well, that's a good point. At that point in time, with Bobby and with my wife, during the late 1990s, and again, I was involved in politics at that point. I was elected county commissioner in 1995. Which amounted to be somewhat like a governor of a small state. I was gone most of the time, all of the time. And so things were going on in the house that I wasn't really aware of. The kids were kind of on their own. And it really didn't start to come together until the early 2000s. Now, Your listeners might think, well, why did it take so long if this evil entity was in the house? Or why didn't it strike right away? These things, I believe, have no sense of time and place like we do. I mean, they're eternal creatures. A day is like a minute. I think it was slowly setting up, setting its pieces up, so to speak. Before it surrounded us to strike. So later on, after things really started to hit the fan, absolutely I thought about just leaving. And there was a point in time when I was first dealing with priests of the Catholic Church, who the Bishop, Bishop Worrell, now Cardinal Worrell, assigned to work with us. And one of the priests said to me from the very beginning, you have a decision to make. You can either take your family and sell this house to someone else and move on, or you can stay and fight. Or I should say not fight, stay and we'll try to deal with this. And what alarmed me the most when he said that was, we'll know in a year if we're making progress. So he already knew what type of battle it was going to be.
What? I mean, that's pretty impressive that you got the Catholic Church that involved and that quickly, and that you have somebody of such a high stature willing to come in and take a part of this. Did that help to secure your confidence and think, okay, well, it's not like I'm just dealing with some, you know, drugstore corner preacher out there. I'm dealing with a big person involved in the church, whether you buy into that at all or not. For yourself, at least, did that give you some sense of you know, this is all going to be okay. This guy knows his stuff.
Exactly. Just to make a few comments. I mean, when we can talk a little bit later about when it really got serious and when I knew that I needed help. You know, we were Protestant. I went to the pastor of our church again. Not to disparage him at all. He had never dealt with anything like this, but I knew that the situation I found myself in with my children, with the house, with things flying through the air, and the whole house had just taken on this oppressive, evil feel. And I mentioned to him that there was something wrong. I needed help. And he certainly wasn't prepared to offer any.
Well, it's always so easy for people, Bob, to say, well, as soon as my family start getting mucked with, it's time to pull out. But I think it's important to mention as an experiencer, and if I'm wrong, please correct me on this. I've heard from many different family members, even from the Amityville Horror cases, haunting in Connecticut, haunting in Georgia, you know, the people involved in The Conjuring, their real house. When it's going on, you almost are so close to the forest you can't see the trees kind of feel to it. It's like, this can't be real. Even though you've had these experiences, you're constantly trying to talk yourself out of believing what's going on around you. Was that part of why you and your family weren't just so easy to jump ship?
No.
Okay.
I did come to realize that we were dealing with something that was very serious. And what became relatively quickly very sinister. And I was not fooled that it was still some type of Casper the Friendly Ghost situation. This thing became very first person. When I say first person, this isn't like dealing with some ghost that you occasionally see wandering through the hallway. This was interactive. It was almost like living with the Invisible Man. This thing dealt with us and harassed us on a daily basis. So that when I knew that I needed help, I can remember feeling lost. What do you do? I mean, it's not like you call Bill Murray and the Ghostbusters, even though I would have if I could have. It's not like you open up the phone book. Who do you call? Well, at the time, again, I was out of office by then, but my one good friend was still mayor of the city of Pittsburgh, and a close friend. I told him what was happening, and he said, I'm going to go see the bishop, of which he did. And he met with Bishop Worrell and came back to me and said, tonight at 7 o'clock, you're going to get a phone call from a priest, and we'll see where it goes from there. And with that, first conversation, and I could tell that the man on the other side of the phone wasn't befuddled by it. He wasn't amazed by it. He was very serious, very businesslike, you know, kind of confronted me with the choice we had to make. Were we going to stay? Were we going to go? And that this would not be easy. And we had a struggle ahead of us. I thought, you know, the priest would come in, do hocus pocus, you know, say some Latin prayers, dominoes and biscuits and so on, and you know, it would be over.
Did you ever at any time, Bob, think, well, okay, this is going to go on. They said it's going to take a while. Maybe I should send the kids to go live with Aunt Mary for a month until we get this thing under wraps. Or was the church encouraging you to all stay together, united, to help fight whatever was in your home?
The same priest I spoke to, I would say, almost every day. And there were other priests that actually came to the house probably every 10 days or so. Now, the battle and what went on was still left to us to deal with. And I did consider at one point moving at least my two sons out, but I became so focused and so engaged with this thing, especially after we learned how to strike back at it. And it became almost a test of endurance, a test of wills. And I felt that by moving my children out would be giving ground and admitting that it was winning. Now, what I did do at one point was my daughter and had gotten married, and her and her husband and young child lived on the third floor for a short time. The thing went after her baby one night, and I subsequently rented a house for them to go live in.
Now, when you say it went after her baby, and we only have about 3 minutes left in this segment, I can't leave the audience hanging on that. What did it do that put that baby in danger?
Well,
and I understand you've got a book to sell too, and you don't want to give away all the secrets, but I mean, was it a manifestation? Did you see something?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Very quickly on the third floor, it's set up to be like a servant's maid's quarters, you know, a separate little in-house apartment with a separate room off of that two-room apartment that was meant to be an attic room, which we turned into a nursery for the baby. One evening, her new husband was walking up the steps. He opened the door to look in on the baby, and in the darkness, he saw a figure standing over, looking over the crib. And he thought it was his wife, my daughter, and he said, what are you doing here with the lights out? And he just moved into the room, and as he moved into the room, this dark shape moved into the wall, into the crawl space, at which point he just was just completely blown away. What did I just see? He went in, got my daughter, and then called us upstairs. He had no idea of some of the things that we had been experiencing. It was still in the initial stages, and it wasn't long after that we moved them out.
Now, these black mists and footsteps and things that were going on with your son, and again, we've got about a minute and a half left in this segment, were they beginning to happen on a more regular basis? Was it once a month, once a week, once a night? How effective, or I shouldn't say effective, but how often did this happen?
Well, eventually, if we didn't see it, the way I sensed its presence, and again, we can get in more detail, is that it gave off this horrific stench. We called it kind of a pillar of stench that would move through the rooms, and this smell did not take up the whole room. You could only smell it if you were standing right next to it, like someone who had bad breath or bad body odor. When it moved away, the smell would move with it. So if we weren't seeing the black shadow consistently, the smell would be present. And it would do that to taunt me.
Would visitors have experiences as well, or did it hide and only manifest for you and your family?
No, when the priests would come, and I would also have friends there too, close friends, with, you know, these long ceremonies that the priests would engage in would involve mass. It would always be several hours. This thing would manifest itself during those time periods. So the priests experienced it, and visitors would experience it, and certainly the folks from Penn State, Ryan Buell and Adam Bly, can testify to not only seeing the black shape, but smelling it as well.
The Demon of Brownsville Road, Bob Cranmer, our guest for the evening. We've been hearing a little bit of the background and about the activity that was taking place in his home. When we return after the top of the hour, we'll start to find out about how one goes to battle with the forces of evil, and more importantly, how do you finally define what's demonic as opposed to just a malevolent ghost? Bob Cranmer, our guest, will return with more Coast to Coast right after this.